You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Get that warm cup on your hands.
I am using it. This is my current source of warmth, all right? And it's working well. Oh my gosh.
We got the deep freeze. It's good for focused work. I've found that over the last 3 days. I've had a lot of focused work because I've been forced to stay in the house.
It's very punishing if you go outside, yes. It's like the roads are icy. If I go visit a friend, I'm risking life and limb. I might as well get work done, you know?
Yeah. Why risk it? You can just sit at the computer. You can play with all these AI tools. You can push towards a goal you may have. But I think the idea of focus work is apropos for this discussion, because I know that you've had a lot of focus work building out Magnolia relatively under the radar behind the scenes for the last couple of years. And as we were discussing before we hit record, I'm sitting down with Harsha Goli. And for those of you who are not familiar with Harsha, he's been in the industry for quite a while and worked on many impactful projects and companies. And so I think instead of me giving your background, it probably makes sense for you to do that, Harsha, sort of explain your journey within the Bitcoin industry over the last better part of a decade, over a decade now, I think.
Dude, thank you for the incredibly warm intro. Yeah, we're over a decade now. I started working in the space back in 2015. I was just like a sophomore in college. And, you know, back then was really into like open source, you know, like anything, right? So I just like me and my friends, we would just go to hackathons and just work on, you know, like whatever GitHub projects we could find, make them better or like create something completely new and like ship stuff. And at one of them, you know, someone was telling me about Bitcoin. And the best part of it about Bitcoin was that it was a financial thing that was open source. And I'm like, okay, neat. I can mess with this. Of course, I didn't know C. You know, I only knew Python and JavaScript. So I would like try to like find whatever clobbered together libraries other people would put together. If anyone else is listening who was a dev around the time, the state of Bitcoin tooling back then was abysmal, which, you know, was pretty awesome for me to work in. And yeah, like from there, I decided like, okay, this stuff is pretty cool. I'd like to work on this stuff a little bit more. So at the time I had like, you know, a junior, you know, like job at a company called GE, GE Power specifically, that division. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I'd like to work on Bitcoin stuff. That they work on turbines. So that's not really the same thing. So I got a job at BitPay, which was in Atlanta. And yeah, they just like had me working on, effectively, this was very controversial. Now we're way past it, but they had me working on like a bunch of SegWit2x tooling, right? So I was like the guy who like spun up the initial SegWit2x testnet. I remember like getting a bunch of like USB miners, all right? And like sticking them into a bunch of Raspberry Pis. We had like 50 of them, you know, in a room, just buzzing away. And I wasn't there for the actual like activation, but I can imagine what day that was, because the whole thing just fell over immediately.
Off by one.
And so that was pretty cool. But it was cool, like setting up a test net, you know, like from scratch. And yeah, like after that, my friends and I, we like, you know, realized like, okay, there's a lot of work in this space and there's a lot of like tools we can work on. So we started our own startup, basically like consulting firm that like had some internal products. And that did really well until eventually I met like some folks from Fold who were looking for a backend engineer, and they wanted to work on some really, really cool stuff. So I was like, okay, well, you know, I know I have this startup, but it's doing pretty well. It can probably chug along without me for a while. Let me just, you know, hop on this team and see what we can do here. And I still remember like the job that I ended up applying for was like, it was a Clojure dev, right? I don't know if any of you guys know about Clojure, but it's a crazy language. And I didn't know any Clojure. Still got the job, got hired. And ended up working on their like backend like wallet infrastructure for a minute, which is how I started getting familiar with like how enterprise wallets really, really worked. And yeah, like from there we shipped Lightning and, you know, Bitcoin for Fold, and eventually like, you know, launched the actual like Fold debit card, right? Which actually is what got traction. Fold did not have too much traction on the gift card stuff. The debit card really took off, even though gift cards never really stopped being part of the bottom line. And then, yeah, like, so from Fold, then, you know, I worked in a bunch of different places. I think Fold was a place where I kind of decided, like, okay, this stuff is better than, like, college. You know, this stuff is better than, like, working on anything else. Just the energy of, like, you know, of Thesis and, like, Will and Tom and all the guys there was just awesome. So after I left there, I went to work at a couple different places, including Lightning Labs, just to work more on Lightning stuff. That was really, really cool. I met some of the smartest people in my life there. And then worked at Voltage as well, got my, like, chops in, like, product management. And then worked at Swan, another, like, company I'm sure all you guys know. Again, doing product management stuff, specifically for their data team and their Lightning teams. And all this was kind of, like, going in a very specific direction because I wanted to learn how to run teams effectively on a myriad of different problems, because there's been, like, this problem that I've been kind of seeing in the space, which is, like, you know, the tech, it, like, even though I've been working on Lightning for a long time and trying to get it implemented with more people, I noticed that most people don't use the new and shiny in Bitcoin. That's never really been a thing about Bitcoin. Tech enthusiasts like myself do, sure, but the masses do not. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized, like, the problem is, it isn't, like, you know, Bitcoin necessarily needs a new, you know, functionality in order to, like, get mainstream. It already was. The problem always was that in order to actually get Bitcoin, you could only go to reliably a couple of the big exchanges. And if you were a small company, smaller than, you know, Coinbase, in order to get that same functionality integrated into your application, the exact same way Coinbase would, you had to do so much, right? And you had to rely on sometimes really sketchy partners. And it was a huge burden. While all, like, it was one of those things where the payoff was immense, but the costs were somehow even more immense, right? I remember at Swan, we had, like, 5 different migrations between, like, all these different providers. It was nonsense, you know, especially when, like, 80% of your 80% of your, like, engineering budget goes toward this one specific problem. That's nonsense to me. But anyway, that's, like, my background in a nutshell. I've been working in Bitcoin for, I think, yeah, over 10 years now. It's the thing I love. I think I'll be working in Bitcoin for the rest of my life, but, you know, why not at this point?
Yeah. And so this brings us to Magnolia, which is the company that you founded and have been working on for a couple of years now. And again, highlighting the end of your introduction there, which is this problem that exists for many companies in the space who basically just want to interact with Bitcoin and make it easy for their customers, most importantly, to interact with Bitcoin. The third-party dependencies that have existed in the industry throughout the years have stood on, for lack of a better term, shaky foundation. And through my conversations with you and what you're doing at Magnolia, that's exactly what you're trying to solve, is providing a sound foundation for companies trying to build in the space.
Yeah, it's quite surprising, actually. You know, like, I got to empathize with all these builders. You know, I feel like if you're a builder in Bitcoin, you've got a pretty, like, tough task ahead of you. And, you know, everyone seems to, like, solve it. But you spend all this time and energy cultivating an audience online, you know, getting them to use the application that you're trying to, like, get them to use, whether it's, you know, a wallet or a Bitcoin lending app or even a white glove service, right? That takes a lot of effort, a lot of energy. It kind of sucks because after you've done all this effort, all this work, you try to make it as easy as possible to onboard your customers, and you realize, like, getting these kind of integrations in your application isn't like, you know, signing up for a credit card, right? Where it's like one form, or going to a bank and, you know, like, signing a couple papers and then, you know, getting access to the financial system. When you try and do this as a business, specifically, like, you know, in Bitcoin and, you know, stablecoins or anything else, it's so tedious, it's so expensive, and it's really just out of reach, right? You basically have two options. One is just get, like, state licenses to get money transmitter, like, you know, like, access, right? And it's state by state. It's not like if I go to a bank and I sign up for a bank account, I can use that bank account anywhere in the US. That's not how it works if you're a business, you know? And then alternatively, you set up an account with someone else who runs the infrastructure for you, And that process is incredibly tedious. I think like for us, it can go over like 3 months when we were doing this, you know, ourselves. And then on top of it, they charge incredibly high minimums. In the neighborhood of like 20 to 30K a month. You know, it's like, this is for a massive like business like Polymarket, you know, not for someone who's like got a pretty effective, you know, retail audience, but not like, you know, I've dominated the world effective, you know? And that's just kind of wild to me. But yeah, so like what we're trying to do, I've really kind of identified as a huge problem in Bitcoin is I'm trying to turn every single one of these applications, like big ones for sure, but also smaller ones as well, into bridges where you can just go with, you know, your credit card, your bank details, whatever, and be able to convert yourself from a pre-coiner to like a Bitcoiner. That's the idea here. All these applications should be able to take someone's money and give them Bitcoin, right? Instead of shoving them off to Coinbase or something.
And so what was the process of building this out like? Let's get a landscape of the technical architecture that exists, and then I guess the compliance architecture necessary to facilitate this as well.
Yeah. So, you know, from a technical point of view, it's actually like, I guess for me, it's not that hard because it's something I built like 3 or 4 times in my career, right? But it's like having an enterprise wallet system, having what's called a double entry accounting ledger. So it's just a well-built like accounting system. And then on top of that, having a robust API that is not overwhelming. That part's, you know, honestly, not the most complicated part. I've done that multiple times. Most people have some version of that in their systems, you know? And then of course, like a connection to your banking partner. And that's where things get hard. The hard part is interacting with the banking providers. The hard part is like, yeah, being able to talk to them, really. It's step one. That was actually kind of wild when I realized just how hard that was going to be at the time. I think like I had really long hair, you know, I had just done like, you know, a huge hippie dive. It was awesome. You know, I lived in the van for a couple of years. And I realized like, okay, I'm going to these conferences, you know, I've got my hair tied up all nice and stuff in order to meet like a lot of these bankers. But I've got to like, you know, make some changes to my appearance here. You know, I've got to like pick up a different kind of like repertoire. And I've got to like cut my hair. I've got to stop referring to ourselves as crypto to try and explain myself to them. Just be like, no, we do Bitcoin. You know, the Bitcoin is the thing we do. You know, we don't get involved with anything else. And after like, honestly, a large number of conferences and conversations, we managed to like find a lot of really healthy inroads into the banking world with really good like compliance folks at our backs too. There's a whole separate world in Bitcoin dedicated just to compliance. And it's like kind of fascinating, right? Like Haley Lennon is a great name in this space too. She's like the general counsel of Fold, right? And she was our lawyer at one point. And she was able to like intro us to all these people who are on the Bitcoin compliance side of things. And they know all the right people in the compliance world to like, you know, get you past all the big roadblocks that exist for kind of everyone else. And that was honestly pretty wild for us to realize like, okay, compliance is not that effective. And the way how compliance tends to work is it's all about like making sure that, you know, who you know is someone with a lot of like moral accountability, essentially. Right. And that does apparently like go quite a long way in the compliance world. And I do kind of see it and understand it now.
Yeah. And so let's take a step back, a high level view. Who is your ideal customer and how do they interact with you going from zero to one?
So right now, like a huge focus for us is we've realized that a huge pain point is, okay, so like Bitcoin, right? Like the biggest value of Bitcoin is the value it has. And I think like 2026 is turning out into this year where a lot of people are moving their Bitcoin into some kind of non-custodial setup, whatever it may be, where they can also take a loan out against it, right? And be able to like utilize the value that they've accrued in some kind of way. But this has been like kind of a silent explosion over the last, like, you know, I think 6 months to a year. And I think it's going to really, really, really get big in 2026. Ledin has like a crazy high ARR now, which is wild. LEDN. They're like, I think, a leader in this space. I think it's like 100 million or something. And the reason why I bring this up is because all these different Bitcoin-backed lending like folks, they all issue the loans in a stablecoin. And something I've learned from talking to all these folks is the whole like narrative for stablecoins for trading is kind of like dead, right? But people are still taking out these loans And that's because they're taking out these loans at decent rates, specifically to use them in the real world, you know, for to pay for their like daughter's, you know, college, or, you know, to upgrade, you know, a property they have or whatever. And so what we're plugging into for a lot of these folks is we're plugging into like their systems to convert their stablecoins to fiat directly for their end user. That way their end user doesn't have to take a couple more points at Coinbase or something like that. So that's someone that we're like really kind of charging headfirst in. But basically our ideal customer is any kind of like, you know, Bitcoin business that's got, you know, a large, like a high retail audience that they're looking to monetize, you know, effectively. We've integrated a couple other wallets as well that are doing just that. And yeah. And, oh, and also anyone who's looking to access the US and EU, like, you know, financial markets, essentially. So South American companies and Asian companies too, who would like to onboard folks from the EU. Super, super valuable for us right now.
So freaks, if you've been listening for a while, you've probably heard us all talk about BitKey. It's a Bitcoin wallet built for people who want self-custody to actually fit into their lives. BitKey is a private multi-sig wallet that removes the biggest point of failure in traditional self-custody, the seed phrase. No ceremony, nothing to hide, and no single mistake that can put your Bitcoin at risk. We all know, things get lost. I lose things all the time. Phones get replaced. Life happens. BitKey specifically is designed so your Bitcoin stays secure and recoverable without demanding constant attention or expertise, because it's built for the long term. Inheritance is built in, so your Bitcoin can move securely into the next generation. It's Bitcoin self-custody built for real life, and for February only, for you freaks, okay? February only, you got 28 days, not a leap year, I'm pretty sure, 28 days. You listeners, TFTC listeners, can get BitKey for $99 using code TFTC99 at bitkey.world. That's BITKEY.world. Use the code TFTC99 and you're going to get a BitKey for $99. Sup freaks, this rip is brought to you by our good friends at Silent. Silent creates everyday Faraday gear that protects your hardware. We're in Bitcoin. We have a lot of hardware that we need to secure. Your wallet emits signals that can leave you vulnerable. You want to pick up Silent's gear, put your hardware in that. I have a tap signer right here. I got the Silent card holder, replaced my wallet. I was using Ridge Wallet because it's secured against RFID signal jacking. Silent, the card holder, does the same thing. It's much sleeker, fits in my pocket much easier. I also have the Faraday phone sleeve, which you can put a hardware wallet in. We're actually using it for our keys at the house too. There's been a lot of robberies. They have essential Faraday slings, Faraday backpacks. It's a Bitcoin company. They're running on a Bitcoin standard. They have a Bitcoin treasury. They accept Bitcoin via Strike. So go to slnt.com/TFTC to get 15% off anything, or simply just use the code TFTC when shopping at slnt.com. Patented technology, special operations approved. It has free shipping as well. So go check it out.
Let's dive into the stablecoins conversation. What are you seeing? You know, like you mentioned the trading narrative, which was the stablecoin, the predominant stablecoin narrative for many years, I think makes sense.
Yeah.
It was birthed out of Bitfinex, which is this big exchange. And there was obviously the ability to send these stablecoins between exchanges to arb prices, or just get better margin rates on different exchanges at any given point in time. But it seems like it's breaking out of that, the confines of trading only, and breaking into true, for lack of a better term, utility for everyday retail consumers who aren't traders. Do you see it coming to America? I think that's a big question I have in my mind right now. Do stablecoins make sense in the United States? And then even if they do or don't, what is the activity like outside of the United States from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I think everyone knows that there's a lot of activity for stablecoins in like developing nations, specifically in South America and Central America. But the U.S., now what's happening in the U.S. is actually quite fascinating right now, because of the Genius Bill. The Genius Bill creates a lot of pressure to implement stablecoins somewhere in the U.S., right? Like in the U.S., like banking system in particular. That's fundamentally what the Genius Bill does. And if y'all aren't aware of like how the Genius Bill really works, it basically creates a ton of incentive to buy up T-bills and then issue stablecoins against these T-bills, right? And so now you have like a lot of like stablecoins that are rolling around. Like, okay, we need to find a use for these stablecoins in order to like justify like our business, right? Because we're giving most of our, return from the T-bills that are generated back to the end user, which is, you know, a whole conversation in and of itself. But we have these stablecoins and we need to fit them somewhere. And so what we're kind of seeing is we're seeing this like really kind of backwards thing happen, where normally if people implement products and stuff, after there's some level of demand, But what we're seeing with stablecoins is people are implementing stablecoins everywhere and seeing where they fit, you know, what sticks and what doesn't stick. And one of the things that's sticking quite well is this concept of, okay, everyone's got some amount of like, you know, like Bitcoin or maybe even like some other assets as well that they want to take out loans against. Taking out the loans typically ends up being part of this, you know, like protocol, either it's a smart contract, you know, on Aave or something like that, or, you know, more like, I think gaining more popularity, it's some kind of like Bitcoin backed loan, right? But either way, it doesn't really matter. You're going to get a stablecoin as a result of this loan. And getting a stablecoin is cool, but a lot of these people are not using these loans to like gamble more. That's just not what a lot of these folks are doing. They're using it to like actually improve their lives in some way. These loans are not that high anymore. I think before it made a lot of sense to kind of gamble on, you know, another project or whatever when they were between like, you know, 15 and 12. But now you see them going kind of low. In some platforms, it's as low as like 6%. I think a pretty good price you can get in Bitcoin is 10%. And those are like low enough to actually justify like building, you know, real value in the real world, you know? And that's kind of fascinating. So seeing that take off is really kind of interesting. Where else will stablecoins fit? I don't know. You know, I'm a skeptic in general. I like seeing things before I believe it. You know, I call me crazy, but I don't know where else it fits right now. But I see that one really kind of like actually getting use cases right now. I'd be very curious to see if anyone uses them like on the day-to-day elsewhere.
Yeah. It's obviously a big topic of discussion right now with the Genius Act. And again, it seems like they're trying to manufacture demand for these treasuries. And that's the one thing, the big question in my mind is it a be careful what you wish for scenario with the Genius Act, where you have to recognize that stablecoins, the success of stablecoins to date has been driven by this regulatory gray area that's existed and allowed individuals outside the borders of the United States to get access to dollar instruments rather trivially.
I mean, like to their point, the reason why they're doing it, why they're so like interested in doing it is because if it's not the US dollar, it's the Chinese like yen, right? It's the Russian ruble. And so everyone wants to like take advantage of these like, you know, deteriorating economies and just plant our flag in them first. You know, we've done this with real dollars, like in the past, you know, especially like in Africa to stabilize economies and, you know, in Zimbabwe, like, you know, after the currency, like went to hyperinflation, people started using the US dollar, you know, that is what happened. But I do agree that it is quite literally artificial demand, you know, that's what the Genius Bill is. And I do think it's interesting that we're just trying to like fit it in anywhere we can. I look forward to the day when my Walmart app offers stablecoin as a rewards option. You know, like I'm sure that's coming. You know, that's going to be wild.
Switching gears a little bit and building on conversations we've had over the years, I think Magnolia, the impetus for you starting it again, as you alluded to, is that there are companies that have tried to do something similar in the past. I think most notably Prime Trust, and have failed epically. And so I guess, what are the lessons learned from their failures in how you're trying to improve on that and make sure that Magnolia is sound?
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I remember Prime Trust, the first version of Fold built against Prime Trust, you know? And we, you know, frankly loved it. It was great from a tech point of view. It was everything we ever wanted. It's just that, it turns out the way how their operating side worked was not, you know, everything we wanted. There's this like really kind of incredible story with Prime Trust and also, I think also like Fortress Trust, where they ended up just losing a ton of money because they had some like really complicated key ceremony, right? And the result of this really complicated key ceremony was they ended up losing the actual private keys that backed the deposit addresses, right, at Prime Trust. And so people were depositing money at Prime Trust. And for, I think, a couple weeks, no one realized that they were putting money into a black hole. You know, they really were. And when it came time to withdraw the money, you know, for typical operation purposes, only then did they realize, like, we don't have this cash. You know, Prime Trust wasn't hacked. You know, or they may have been hacked at some point in their history, but this specific instance, they weren't hacked. And that is just baffling to me. So, like, really, my career is kind of built on the failures of these entities. And it's not just Prime Trust. You know, there's a couple of them out there. Because folks like me and myself, you know, specifically, we had to deal with these ramifications, right? So we learned a lot. Some of the big things that we really learned is, like, the compliance folks, the operation folks, and the engineering folks, they have to be in the same room. They cannot operate independently, you know? They need to constantly talk. They need to understand, like, okay, here's what we're implementing. This is how we're doing it. This is what our, you know, our own, like, policies say, and here's what needs to get modified. This has been a really, really valuable exercise for us every time it happens, specifically because really often we realize something can get shaved down. Something doesn't have to get complicated, right? Or even, okay, we're implementing something that is actually very dangerous for us, you know? And that is kind of a huge boon. From the security side, we made the decision that my computer is just completely segregated away from all of our systems. And, you know, from ensuring that our, like, security is on top, our CTO, he's 100% in charge of that. And that's his focus, right? Alongside, like, building features and stuff. But this separation of concerns makes it so that, like, I'm able to work on my stuff and he's able to work on his stuff. And my job is just ensuring the machine gets to keep going forward. And his job is making sure that the machine is well-oiled enough to go forward. The separation of concerns works out, I think, a lot better. I know that the Prime Trust method of doing this stuff was a little bit more democratic, where, you know, keys were separated between a bunch of different people. We have separated keys out. It's not one individual, but our keys aren't separated between individuals. They're separated in, like actual different key servers, you know? Then only one individual who's, you know, like, got a shotgun at home and takes security very seriously, like, you know, is in charge of. And I think that's probably, like, the right way for how we handle things right now.
So, freaks, when you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. And it always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
What's up, freaks? Been seeing a lot of YouTube comments. Marty, your skin looks so good. You're looking fit these days. How are you doing it? Well, number one, I'm going to the gym more, trying to get my swell on, trying to be a good example for my young sons, a fit, healthy dad. But part of that is having a good regimen, particularly staying hydrated, making sure I have the right electrolytes and salts in my body. That is why I use Salt of the Earth. I drink probably three of these a day with one packet of Salt of the Earth. I'm liking the pink lemonade right now. It's my flavor of choice. This is their creatine. I've added this to my regimen. They have it in these packets as well. Makes it extremely convenient if you're traveling. You want to work out while you're traveling, but you don't want to be carrying a white bag of powder and going through TSA. It's very, very nerve-wracking at times. You have to explain, hey, it's not what you think it is. It's creatine. I'm trying to get my swell on. Make sure you're staying hydrated. I have become addicted to these. It's made my life a lot better. I can supplement this for coffee in the morning and be energized right away. I can bring the creatine wherever I need to, just put a couple packets in here before I head to the gym, bring this to the gym, drinking out of a glass bottle, make sure I'm not injecting any microplastics into my body. Go to drinksote.com, use the code TFTC, and you'll get 15% off anything in the store. That's drinksote.com, code TFTC.
What is this, this key setup? I mean, you mentioned multiple different servers. One guy, like, how do you ensure that there's no key man risk with the setup?
Yeah, so we use multiple different key servers from like different other like custodians specifically, right? So they're all like watching out. I think like a lot of it is automated, but you know, for deposit addresses, those go into cold storage directly, but it's not cold storage that's run like by us. It's cold storage run by someone else. That way, you know, like there isn't really a situation where we mess up. Our money that we send out is, you know, completely segregated from money that we receive. So there's just an operations focus to make sure that, you know, we always have enough money to withdraw. Yeah, like we've had to go through kind of a lot of iterations of this design for our compliance program specifically. And so we have this all really well documented in our policies. And whenever regulators or banking partners or even customers ask us for these, we're able to like kind of provide specifications like kind of on hand, which is nice, you know. But yeah, it's really, in my opinion, nothing that isn't industry standard, you know. Now, this kind of separation of concerns is what everyone should be doing, right? It's something super crazy or magical.
Are the regulators getting smarter on this, on how this technical architecture should be built? They're
not really on the technical architecture side of things. They're really concerned about like over-leveraging rehypothecation and making sure that certain individuals are touching it or not touching it, right? Like that's really what they care about. And they've gotten smarter in the sense that they're not going to allow like fancy diagrams to get in the way of their understanding, right? So if we send them diagrams and they don't understand it, they'll tell us it's not understandable at the back, you know, make it better. Fair enough, you know, like, so, which we've done a couple of times. We have like a whole like project for diagrams specifically for regulators, like for this topic. And they're huge. They're like PowerPoint presentations that are like over 200 pages long, right? Or 200 slides long. But it works, you know, they get it. They get the idea.
Yeah. And so now, I mean, you've got a big announcement coming up. We're recording this on Tuesday, the 27th, but I think over the weekend, you guys are going to be coming out with some news, and this will be published after. So by the time this reaches the audience, the news will be announced. What do we have in store?
So, like later this past year, right? I think in December, we launched a price oracle, right? We want to see how it would do. We found some people really liked it and, you know, onboarded it. And this price oracle works specifically with discrete log contracts, right? So it's like a much more like trustless way of handling these Bitcoin-backed loans. And we also like announced that, you know, okay, we're supporting, and so instead of stable coins, you know, you can do disbursements for these loans via fiat. So you can get, you know, cold hard cash in your bank. And people are really excited about that. So the big announcement that will be out by time, that by the time you guys hear this, is that we are releasing our full-fledged like banking products for everyone to use, right, in the US and soon the EU. And so when I mean in the US, I mean we can launch this in New York, Florida, California, Texas, and all the states in between. And what this product is, it's a full bank, right, over an API. So you can spin up individual accounts, right, like, you know, routing account number for each of your end users through this system. If that's what you want to do, put fiat into it or have it do an ACH pull, which is like auto pay, convert it into Bitcoin, and then send it to whoever it is you need to send it to. This is, to my knowledge, the quickest way to convert someone, like convert someone's fiat to Bitcoin or Lightning, and the most programmatic and like expendable way or whatever. Oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the term, but yeah. This is the most like programmatic way you can do it. So that's kind of a huge, huge win. So there's no iframes involved in this. It's not MoonPay or anything like that, which means that people can create their own custom flows as they'd like, right? And that also does include with AI. So as long as you're onboarded with us in past KYB, which we've gotten down from 6 weeks to less than a week now. So it's really easy to get turned around on that. You can just like implement our API into existing infrastructure and turn any application into a full-fledged bank. That's huge. That's what I wish I had 5 years ago.
How's this work on the licensing side of things? Similar, yeah. Prime Trust in that way where you guys have licenses and charter.
So we have some licenses, but really like the big change that we made in 2025 is we realized like what we should do instead is we should really focus on getting, like, everyone is just saying, this is great. Come back. Like we'd love to talk when you have more than, you know, a couple states, right? We realize people want to go to all these states. So we figured out a way with our banking partners. We have three different banking partners to use our licenses in different states so that we can actually just go to all these different states all at once, right? It turns out some of our banking partners also have locations in the EU as well. So we can do native European transfers, so not SWIFT, in the EU. We're working on implementing that right now. That has to come in a month or two after we do the US launch, but this brings our services kind of everywhere right now. In the future, I think it's going to make sense for us to, like, you know, finish up these applications. Unfortunately, these applications normally take like, you know, a year or two. Right now, because of all the stuff that's going on, everyone's backlogged. So it's actually going to take even longer than that. So we realized, okay, we're going to have to like come back to the applications whenever the regulators get back to us, you know, and just kind of like handle it from there. But till then, you know, we can go in all these states and bring our services to just about anyone we can. And that's a pretty big win for us, right? It's gotten people really excited.
Yeah. You mentioned AI. How do you see AI playing into all this? Because I've been leaning into it as heavily as possible here at TFTC, doing research at 1031, things like that. And it is becoming more and more powerful by the day. I was actually playing around with, I had my agent playing around with Money Dev Kit last night, and it was pretty cool to see what it can do. So how do you see this intersection of AI and not only what you're doing at Magnolia, but Bitcoin more broadly?
Dude, the financial system should not be locked out to people who are building. It just should not be, right? We want to make it as accessible as possible. So if people want to utilize, like, you know, banking in their like Vibecard products, we can make sure that they do it safely, right? But AI can actually do the implementation, create incredibly delightful flows for people. And yeah, I agree. We've been leaning into it pretty hard too. It's helped us out kind of tremendously. The different like teams at Magnolia handle it very differently, right? So our engineering team has a very like complex and precise method of handling AI that's very different from how our compliance team handles it. And our compliance team was able to reduce its, you know, like our KYB process, our onboarding process, from like 6 weeks down to like less than one with the help of AI, just like, you know, optimizing what it can and reducing flows and trying to get as many like, you know, multiple birds hit with one stone, so to speak. And I use it kind of all the time, specifically with the Ralph Wiggum loop, if you're familiar with that. I use that all the time for our docs and our like main web page as well. That way I don't have to bother our devs about it. And, you know, I can make sure our docs are as accurate as possible. I'm actually watching it run right now because, you know, I'm going to El Salvador tomorrow and I need this new website like out. So I'm just like watching it just iterate. But we use it kind of a lot. And I do kind of have this belief that I've always been against hiring as a growth metric, right? I do believe AI is going to really be able to like supercharge really, really powerful operators at a company and let people go even farther with, you know, their seed or pre-seed stage, right? We've come pretty far on pre-seed. And, you know, at some point we're going to like raise our next round, but we don't want to just, you know, like burn capital here for the sake of burning capital. We want everyone to go as far as they can. And AI really does supercharge folks.
It's insane. And to your point, that's, I think if you're a founder out there not leveraging these tools, obviously you got to be careful to an extent. It's easy to foot gun yourself if you're not using it appropriately. But to your point, if you're a sort of high level operator that understands the risk and understands how to use it, if you're not utilizing it, you're going to get, I don't want to say maybe left behind, but I think from a sort of balance sheet management perspective, there's no reason not to lean into it so you can keep headcount as low as possible, get to revenue, profitability, and begin stacking sats as quickly as possible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Plus, like with all the Twitter stuff, it's all everyone gets to see. So, you know, you have no excuse. You got no excuse. All the tricks are right there. Claudebot is big, or I think now it's renamed. But, you know, whatever the next trick will be, I'm sure it'll be very useful.
Multbot now. Do you think that, though? Like, I wonder if we're in a bubble on Twitter. And yes, it's obviously a
massive topic of discussion in our Twitter bubble. But like, how many people outside of that bubble are actually utilizing these tools or even recognize that they exist and are as powerful as they are?
I think, like, from a retail point of view, most people are already on like ChatGPT specifically because it has a free tier. But using it in this kind of like complex way is definitely in the realm of tech enthusiasts, right? It absolutely is. There's still like a lot of setup, a lot of like stuff you have to do. You have to have like a prerequisite amount of knowledge to understand that Claude Code exists, right? For something like ClaudeBot, you know, maybe like folks buy like the Apple Mini or whatever, where they figure out they can just run it locally. But as time goes on, you're going to see a lot of like products that just spin up the whole thing for you. So like one that's already existed before ClaudeBot is Interaction. If you're familiar with Interaction, it's a Telegram bot, essentially. Pretty delightful startup flow. But as things like this get bigger, you're going to see more full-fledged agents that I think are a little bit more appealing to the mass audience, right? So like a good check for me that I always have is my little sister. She's a chemical engineer, right? That's what she does. She just wrapped up her education, but she is not in tech, not in the slightest, like the way, like, you know, you and I are. And so I ask her, like, you know, what do people think about like AI and stuff like that? And her point of view is, listen, it's cool for like cheating on tests, but as far as like actually doing like chemical engineering work, it's fucking useless, you know? And so like, there's still a lot of room for this stuff to get in the hands of everyday people, you know, people in other like sectors, right? It's really, I think, focused on us right now, people in the tech enthusiast world.
Yeah, that's fun. I was saying a lot of focus work with the snowstorm that hit the Northeast over the weekend. And I had some downtime on Sunday and spent an hour and a half spinning up ClaudeBot and making sure that it was secure behind Tailscale, behind a firewall and all of that stuff. And then I've been slowly but surely conversing with it and iterating on sort of how I'm interacting with it over the last 2 days. And it is insane what this thing can do.
So what's the difference between ClaudeBot and like a Ralph Wiggum loop? Like, would you say ClaudeBot is like significantly like better than like just doing fundamentally the same thing, but in a more like narrow context?
I'll preface this with, I'm not an expert on the intricate differences between Ralph Wiggum, which is essentially you give a product development roadmap with very specific outcomes that you want to complete in sort of a modular fashion. You give it tasks and it just basically runs and checks if it's actually completing those tasks as laid out in the PDR. And once it's done, it's done. Whereas ClaudeBot, and I tried Ralph Wiggum just to play with it for one thing, and I wasn't really able to get it working. So my personal experience, I found a good secure setup for ClaudeBot on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Was successfully able to set it up. I think the one common thing they have is like with Ralph Wiggum, you're storing context in the task files. So like it has context that it can constantly pull from after it clears context. And that's what I think ClaudeBot does as well, just in a different way. And then from what I understand, ClaudeBot, the open source project, just has a bunch of sort of overlaid integrations that have been built out over the last month. It's still a really nascent project, but I don't know, just intuitively for me, as somebody who's not highly technical enough to be dangerous, can get in the terminal and do some stuff with some direction. It's been a much smoother experience for me personally.
You guys should check it out. I've heard really interesting things about it. I think the biggest interesting thing is, like, unlike any other like system, it's not user driven, you know, which is very, very valuable.
What do you mean by that?
My understanding is
sort of autonomous.
Yeah, well, it lets its loop run like regardless of what you're doing with it. So it'll always be checking your DMs. If you ask it to like keep an eye on this or that, you know, it'll constantly just keep an eye on this or that and let you know when things like when you need it like get surfaced. But alternatively, from everything else, you know, for Ralph Wiggum, I have to set the like checklist up and then it executes. And the task I was running here just, you know, like execute, like finished at iteration 38, you know, and now it's done. now it's time to check the work and give a feedback and go on. It's just a bigger loop, but it's still a user-driven loop. But the difference between ClaudeBot is it's not user-driven. This is clearly like the direction that development is going in, right? Like, I think people are going to rely on this stuff like to a crazy degree, especially like 5 years from now, you know, some iterative loop like this. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, know enough to be dangerous, which means know enough to know that I shouldn't just give ClaudeBot everything. So I've been very sort of restrained on the access that I've gotten to have access to Claude code, and I can interact with it via Telegram.
Yeah, we are. It's actually kind of funny. We had like a long conversation in the Magnolia, like all hands yesterday, about like the security concerns of like a lot of these AI tools, right? Because like, you know, we handle PII, right? Like we definitely do. We can't be like turning on. I think it was like the bypass permissions on like, you know, Claude, you know, we can't be piping this stuff in. And like, and that's for the folks who don't have production access, you know? And so like we have to add to our compliance documents, like, okay, you know, we're going to use AI, but this is how we use it. We're going to use it in these like, you know, specific environments where, you know, it doesn't have access to all this other stuff. And it's actually kind of interesting because we're on the side, I think, of we care about security a lot. You know, we care about making sure that this data isn't going to go in the wrong direction. And I can only imagine how other companies or other places like, you know, that lack of, you know, security. And I'm just really looking forward to like, is 2026 going to be the year of just a lot more hacks, you know, like across the whole industry? Because most people are just leaving like their credentials and just, you know, like white text, right? Plain text. And it's going to be a great year for hackers, for black hats.
Yeah. Yeah. Getting familiar with .env files is very important, I think, for a lot of people out there.
Oh, yeah.
How do you think this changes like company building, right? Like we mentioned like headcount and all that, like how, like, I guess to phrase this another way, like how far do you think you can go with a headcount under 20 at Magnolia?
Very far. But when I came to, when I moved to New York, last year, right? I moved into this like hacker house, right? Called The Residency in Chinatown. It was awesome. You know, it was my first time living with a lot of like, you know, kind of deep, like Silicon Valley tech folks who are really just, you know, in the grind and genuinely a great time. And I remember something that they always pointed out about me that I'd never heard anyone refer to me about. They always said that I was a very like agentic person, you know? And I asked them like, what does that mean? Is this like, you know, an AI thing? And they're like, no. It just means that when you see a problem, you do something about it, you know? And I've noticed that in all my founder friends, that's very much who they are. When they see a problem, they do something about it. And I think fundamentally what this is going to allow in the long run is it's going to allow that barrier to entry. So if you just want to do something, you can do it. You know, you see these tweets online where, you know, being an idea guy is like now the alpha, you know? And I do kind of agree with that. I think things have changed now to the point where it's really just a battle of willpower. You know, like how much willpower do you have? It's always been a question of willpower, but sometimes, you know, like people are able to go really, really far in the wrong direction, you know, and that's detrimental to them. That's part of the risk, you know. Are you going, are you waiting until the right moment for your thing, or are you being boneheaded in whatever direction you're going in? And I think with like the advent of these tools, it's going to specifically make it a lot easier for people to iterate and get to the stage that they want to get to, right? Like being able to launch a product and then being able to test a thesis, you know, out, while also being able to maybe get more information on what it is they're trying to do. You know, like it's never been so easy to get feedback on like the greater like context of your space than asking, you know, like a research bot, hey, spend like 3 hours researching anything that has to do with this space here and give me like a competitive analysis of these different like companies and how they're doing and, you know, what flaws might be. It's never been so easy. And I think that does change like the landscape of business quite a lot in the sense that it just, we're reducing information asymmetry, you know, and that lets people make more well-informed decisions while also allowing them to like get more done. You know, before, I think the things that limited founders were very much in the resource like division, you know, like how much money you have, obviously, but also like what your talent pool is, what connections you have. But with modern AI, if you're simply creative enough, you can overcome a lot of these problems. Like I've been, you know, for this launch here, right? We're fundamentally a B2B product. I have to talk to people in order to like, you know, get them to be aware of our product. I've just had Claude, you know, just running against like Twitter and Chrome and say like, hey, you know, look at everyone who follows me, you know, are they working on something that makes sense for like integrating with us, you know, and create like a leads list here and then rank it in terms of like how well I probably know them, you know? And that is something that wasn't possible, you know, before. That's reducing information asymmetry here. There's a lot of things you can do with that. But really that's not like, it's not a question of like how smart is Harsha. It's just a question of how bad does Harsha want it, you know? And I think now more than ever, that barrier is lowered, you know? And I think that's fantastic, frankly, for innovation as a whole.
I completely agree. I think you put that beautifully. People with agency are going to thrive in this world. And I'm not so sure that I'm convinced that it's going to be the job killer apocalypse that it's being marketed as. Certainly it's going to have an effect on the jobs market and will displace a lot of jobs. But I think on the other side of things, I think it was Aaron Levy, the guy from Box.com. He put out an article basically saying like Jevons' paradox of compute is upon us. Like you think just because you're becoming more efficient with these resources, in this case, compute, you're going to use less of it, but what we'll actually find is that we just use more and more. And by extension, one could speculate that means that the potential jobs that exist in the future are way more bountiful than they currently are. And I do think, to your point, we do need some sort of social resurgence of individual agency and creativity to emerge to make that a reality. And there will obviously be a period of time where we're sort of reacting and getting comfortable with this change. But I think people will begin to realize like, okay, this is what these tools can do if I just start thinking in a different way and thinking more creatively and actually getting off my ass and typing into these LLMs, maybe something will happen. And I think that'll have a net positive effect on the job market. Maybe that's naive. Maybe that's too optimistic. Maybe it's a pipe dream, but I could see it playing out that way.
No, I am. Let me ask you a question. Before the power drill, right? How did people fasten like two pieces of wood together, right? Like before we were able to drill things in, how do we screw drills in or screws in? Do you know the answer to this?
Did screws even exist? Was it just like hammered? Yeah.
There was a nail, but there were screws. It's like this like tool. It's like a rod that comes out with a crank handle, right? And there's two parts of it. One is you have to drill the hole first, right? Because it was just, you know, it was too high torque to go through the wood. And then you had to put the long screw all the way in, you know? And this is only really feasible for long screws, right? For anything smaller, you use a nail. But it was a pretty tedious job, you know, frankly. And this was like a specialized part of construction as a whole. And whenever like my friends, like, you know, mentioned, you know, they're worried about AI, like taking everyone's jobs, make everyone like homeless, right? I bring this up, you know, because we're long past that era and no one even remembers that tool anymore. Everyone only thinks about how easy it is to take your drill and screw it in. And I ask people like, do people still have homes? You know, like, do we still build houses? You know, is there a lack of construction jobs right now? No, there's actually a huge boom of construction jobs. Because these tools allow people to build more faster, you know? It just increases the economic output of them. And yes, when electric tools, especially the corded ones and the cordless ones came out, you know, people who like specialize in, you know, like doing this, they got displaced. Absolutely, you know? And that probably sucked for them, you know, genuinely. I like my family and the things that my family, like my mom and dad have done over the years, they've been displaced multiple times. I've been displaced. But economic displacement is a very normal part of any kind of healthy economy. You know, all it means is you got to switch gears. You got to do something else, you know, it doesn't mean you lose your job forever. People oftentimes learn a lot of skills that are, you know, you can use somewhere else. Now, that's a very normal, healthy part of the economy. But the part everyone seems to forget is like the economic output of an individual does compound. Think about all the the hand cranks that are saved now every time you screw in a drill, you know. And I think the exact same thing happens with AI right now. Building all these like products and all these like, you know, simple like SaaS implementations are, you know, hundreds of million dollar like, you know, enterprises that don't necessarily have to be. They don't have to charge such massive amounts. Now people can spin up like, you know, their own competitors to all these massive SaaS products, right? And now like that's a good thing for everyone. The costs go down for everyone as a result, you know? And I do think that like, not even long-term, like short to mid-term, we're going to see a lot of economic like boom that comes out of this. Now that comes with a caveat, and everyone's waiting for this in the AI world. Will enterprise actually pick up tooling that reflects a lot of these AI things, right? That's what everyone's waiting for in the meta of the AI world. And if enterprise is not able to pick up direct AI tooling to fund the AI bubble, then the bubble does pop, you know? And we're going to have to wait for our electric drills a little bit longer, but, you know, still then, right?
Well, dig into that a little further. What do you mean by enterprise figuring this out and getting the tooling right?
Yeah. So, I mean, okay. So right now, like the AI world's in a very specific spot. We put a lot of money in to a lot of these, like, you know, data farms and a lot of these server farms, you know, RAM prices are through the roof and, you know, GPUs are pretty much hard to, like, impossible to find, all that stuff. The thing is, you know, Microsoft and, you know, OpenAI and all these folks only have so much cash to burn on this stuff. And so they've been utilizing a lot of really interesting, like, economic tools to fund a lot of these, like, projects. A lot of these tools, I think the term I've heard from The Economist is they are economic innovations, which is, you know, always a great thing to hear. Everyone's pretty sure that, you know, if these data farms don't, or if these server farms don't work out, it's going to be a relatively big pop, right? And we've already seen a big pop in these, you know, huge hype-driven investments. Like EVs are a huge one, right? Regardless of how you feel about EVs, that project is kind of dead right now, right? Mostly due to the death of government subsidies. And some companies, some manufacturers spent, you know, billions of dollars building battery plants in the U.S., billions of dollars that they're not going to get a good return on. Those same lenders are the ones backing the AI bubble as well, building a lot of these data farms. And so everyone's just kind of like waiting with bated breath. In 2026, does enterprise actually pick up the bill and start paying significant amounts for a lot of these AI tools? You know, people kind of feel like retail is tapped out for AI, and people are trying to figure out ways to monetize retail, you know, more so. I think like the tech enthusiasts are happy to pay the $200 a month, but most retail is just happy with free ChatGPT, and if not free ChatGPT, free DeepSeek, you know, so ChatGPT is going to have to stay free. And so, yeah, like right now everyone's looking for what the next thing is. And, you know, the initial reports are, frankly, enterprise isn't getting that much value out of AI tooling. You know, if anything, they're actually losing money because AI tooling is kind of expensive for them. So we're going to have to see, like, you know, what can a lot of the big guys do to actually change this? And if some decisions that they do don't make that much sense, like implementing ads in ChatGPT or, you know, making it harder to use Claude Code outside of Claude Code, it's due to this, like, large-scale macroeconomics thing. They do need the enterprise angle to pay off. And so that's what I mean by that, Spark, you know, there's a lot going on over there. You know, I hope the bubble doesn't pop, but it could.
No, I mean, as somebody who's been using Claude, pretty heavily over the last 6 months, I look at my usage, look at my bill, and I'm like, dang, just like knowing how hard I've hammered it. And some days I'm like, I'm definitely not paying enough for this as being subsidized to some extent. And it's like, how long can that subsidization persist before the reality sets in and you don't have a deeper sort of investor pockets to dig into, which is interesting. It's like, are we going to see a dot-com bubble like pop and sort of valley of despair for a few years and the market eventually figures it out between now and 2030, like, okay, here's how to do it. And not only do it, but do it in a way where you can make money and actually makes economic sense and consumers are paying for what they're consuming, and the producers of that that product are actually making money, because that's all it comes down to. You have to make money at the end of the day. But then you also have this like existential geopolitical angle to it, where it has been deemed existentially critical to the future of freedom in the digital age, America versus China. So you do have daddy Uncle Sam, who seems pretty motivated to step in and back it up as well.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's the only thing I know is that technology advancements always come in waves, right? There's always a big one and then it crashes. That's the same thing that happened with EVs. You know, we're on like, I think the third or fourth waves of EVs. People forget there was a wave in the 80s, you know, during the oil crisis. And like there was a wave in the mid 2010s. And there was a recent wave that just crashed there. Now, you know, the Ford Lightning is going to go and throw in a gas generator, you know, so that's about how that's going. And I might buy it, you know, complete transparency. I think that's awesome. But will AI like have a crash? It would follow the pattern of every other technological advancement if it did.
Yeah. Just using pure heuristics, it would make sense that it should at some point. Bringing this back to Bitcoin. What are your thoughts on the current state of Bitcoin, both from a economic, technical adoption standpoint, and then the industry, the state of the Bitcoin industry, where it is right now, where it could be 12 months from now, particularly if Magnolia takes off?
Or changing. I don't know if you saw, but OpTX Hash has a BIP now, right? Which is interesting. I think it came out like an hour or two before I hopped on. So that's interesting. Basically at the high level of Bitcoin, right? You zoom out as much as possible. There's where is Bitcoin going at an enterprise level? Where is Bitcoin going at a legal level? And then where's Bitcoin going at a tech level, right? And when it comes to the enterprise plays, there have been some interesting plays over 2025. But by and large, the value of Bitcoin has always been the actual buy sell price of Bitcoin. People are trying to take advantage of that in really interesting ways. Like MSTR, you know, has always been how do we acquire more of this on the bet that it's going to go up? And you know, we're going to use all these different devices to get that to get that going, right? And I think Bitcoin treasury companies are always some version of that, right? It's, you know, I'm not trying to say if it's good or bad, but that's they're playing on the price of Bitcoin. And that seems to be like more of the enterprise play when it comes to Bitcoin. When it comes to the legal aspect of Bitcoin, it's pretty much just riding the coattails of the Genius Bill and the Clarity Act, you know? I think all those conversations are about stablecoins, but Bitcoin just kind of follows, you know, along, right? It's just hanging out in the same conversation, but not the part that everyone's like fighting this way or that way over. It's people are fighting over the stablecoins and the yield from the stablecoins and what to do with that. And then when it comes to the tech side of Bitcoin, the thing is, Bitcoin has had a lot of tech improvements over the years, almost none of them getting serious adoption, right? I mean, not just Lightning. Lightning, you know, when I mean serious compared to Bitcoin, right? Lightning is there and has, you know, been awesome for a while, but now we've got Spark and Arc and, you know, a lot of other like layer twos that are coming up, and, you know, those are all fine and do like interesting things. But then there's all these like other upgrades to Bitcoin coming along, like, you know, whether or not covenants come to Bitcoin, all these different questions. But the thing is, compared to the other two things I described, the enterprise and the legal changes that are, you know, in the Bitcoin space, all these tech innovations, they do seem smaller, right? Significantly. And as a developer, right, that's my entire background, I would like to see those innovations be bigger and make more of a splash. But that's just not the part of Bitcoin people are really interested in, you know? So for Magnolia, I want to follow the things that like have much bigger splashes, you know, which to us seems to be tooling and services that have to do regarding with the price of Bitcoin. You know, like pragmatically, that's just the direction that everything is in. So if there's a way we can use the price of Bitcoin to make other people money or to, you know, like convert pre-coiners in, that's where I think Magnolia wants to be. For these other projects, I want to support them the best I can, because there might be like some way to, you know, have a really cool like lending protocol related to some of these things, or a really cool like way to bridge gaps here with Lightning. We support Lightning at Magnolia, and that lets us plug in things like Arc and maybe even Spark. And that's fantastic. But I think the future for 2026 is going to be a lot like really focused on these bigger folks right now. I think the thing that people haven't really talked about is that the retail isn't pumping in Bitcoin, and not even AI, you know? So I think people are feeling squeezed right now, but the enterprises are out here and they're doing things. So that's where Magnolia's got to be.
Yeah, there's an order of operations to Bitcoin's long-term success, something I've long said. And I mean, expressed in other ways, like store value, medium exchange, unit of account, whatever it may be. It seems like we're still squarely in the early phase of adoption where it's monetizing, and like it or not, that is where a lot of the money is going to be made at this particular point in time and where a lot of the activity is. But to your point about the second layers too, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on that. Like, how much do you think people in the industry should even market them? Right. So you think of like Spark, Arc, Chami Mints, Liquid, these second layers. Like, I think 2025 was the year, at least in my perspective, that people in the industry begin to realize, oh, all these things are interoperable. And if we can combine them in creative ways, we can eke out efficiencies and really improve our processes as a Bitcoin service provider. One thing that comes to mind is like being able to automatically rebalance channels by combining Arc and Lightning. Obviously, caveat, like at scale, you'll probably need covenants, but we're not at that point yet. Point that I'm trying to make is like, how much of these second layer technologies should even be marketed to the public? And should they just be viewed as sort of back-end infrastructure that app developers and product developers integrate and don't even really market to the end user that's what's happening in the back end?
I think that second part, like all this stuff is really complicated for even people in this space, you know, all these different protocol schemes. But to your point, it's becoming pretty interoperable, you know, and I think we're going to have it's going to have its moment when there is a killer application somewhere in this like whole, you know, ecosphere. But all these different ecosystems work together quite effectively. So let's say, you know, we partner with like Arc, for example, and someone else partners with Spark, and both of them are trying to like interact with some application on like some layer two that is neither of those, right? But everyone has bridges. We can all interact with the end application just like quite fine, right? And I think that is a world like worth kind of like going for, you know? Like, if that explosion occurs, everyone wins, especially when it's interoperable. How soon will it take to get there? I have no idea. I think we're firmly past the era where there's like a lot of, you know, frankly, just like scam projects out there. I think that the guys that are left are like probably pretty good at this point. I've been paying attention to, I think like a couple days ago, I checked in on a couple projects that I was always a little skeptical of, just to see what they were up to. I hadn't heard about them, and you know, I don't think they're doing super well, which is good to see that, you know, they're not going to get involved in any of our conversations. But that's a good thing, because now I can kind of like generally start to trust, like, okay, we've weeded out a lot of folks from 2025. The guys that are left, they're still building and they're launching and they're doing things. Let's see what they come up with. And if they come up with something good, hopefully there's a way we can all bridge over there with minimal cost, you know, then everyone really wins out on one person's gain. You know, I think that's like kind of the strategy other projects have really taken when they had like, you know, a lot of, you know, different projects that needed to interact with each other for whatever reason. I think that was a winning strategy. You know, as long as it's all based on Bitcoin, I'm happy.
Yeah. And considering where the price is too, like I get a bit of guilty pleasure out of the price consolidating, like it has some people freaking out. And I think it's been a trope for at least as long as I've been in Bitcoin, like building happens in the bear markets. Not to say that this is a bear market like we've experienced in the past, but it feels like that to many, particularly many who are relatively new to Bitcoin. And if you just zoom out and look at all the progress that's been made, whether that's in the business sector, industry being built on top of the protocol, or the protocol and the second layer protocols being built on top of it. It's been pretty massive from my perspective. It's the signal in the sea of price noise that exists in my mind.
Yeah, I think if you're someone who thinks that this is a bear market, then, you know, just don't worry. Like, you know, you'll lose that idea over time. Every now and then I like see a tweet like the price is down and it's like actually higher than the last time I knew the price. And I'm just like, oh, I don't like, yeah, like I've been in Bitcoin long enough to what even is the price right now? I have no idea. Something really probably. Yes. Oh, it's at 88. That's funny. I think the last time I saw it was at 86. So I'm not too upset.
88. Lucky number 88. Yeah. This has been awesome. What parting thoughts, messages, ideas around Magnolia that we haven't touched on do you have for the freaks out there?
Yeah. I mean, like, really, what we're trying to do is just make it easy to get banked, right? Like to get you banked, to get your customers banked so that you can just implement whatever interface you want, right? Like you can go as far as creating a neobank if that's what you want to do with Magnolia. If you want just auto pay or even just auto DCA, you can do that with Magnolia. Like what we're trying to do here is just create as much financial tooling as possible for the builders. And if there's something that, you know, that you would like to see that you don't think we have, reach out, you know, maybe there's a way you can do it. Where I'm a very customer first person, right? If people tell me they want to go to EU, we'll go to EU. We figured out a way to do it. People told us that they wanted to go to all 50 states, you know, and that's what they wanted to focus on. They don't want to focus on geofencing people from like Alaska, right, or Indiana. So we figured out a way to do that, you know. We're very like customer focused, and I think that's really worked out for us. And our launch is kind of based on what people have really wanted. So, you know, if you're building something and you've got a customer base that you want to like, you know, connect to TradRails for whatever reason, reach out. There's probably some way we can help you. Like genuinely, I think all Bitcoin apps can utilize something like this. Yeah. And even if you just want to like say hi, also would love to just talk to people. I love chatting with people in Bitcoin. Y'all are my people, you know, so I just love to talk.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you for your time today. Congrats on getting this over the line. I know it's been a lot of hard work on your end and the end of your team there at Magnolia. So looking forward to seeing you guys really get out there, and we'll have to do this at some point again in the future.
Dude, till next time, man. Thank you so much for having me on, and I'll catch you when I see you.
Peace. Right. Peace and love, freaks. Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time, and until next time.